Talking with Howard Bloom, and we're going in 10 directions at once and at the same time somehow moving the ball forward at the same time, and we'll open up the phones somewhere during the middle of this hour, and we'll stand by with those numbers so that you too can join in this conversation just before the top of the hour. I posed an essay question. I want to expand it, okay? Let's pretend we're doing an SAT here. Islam is to Islamicist as Judaism is to Zionist as Christianity is to Crusader. Where are you with those? Do they follow? And have we ever really seen anything like this global push to use terrorism as a form of evangelism?
My God, this is a good question and a multifaceted one. Okay, let's go back to the SAT part of the question. Let's just change it a little bit.
Okay.
Islam is to jihadism, that is going out and making war. The question is Islam's relationship to jihadism the same as Judaism's relation to Zionism and Christianity's relationship to militant fundamentalism,
or
the kind of fundamentalism you find in militant encampments in Idaho,
or in its historic context as a crusader, somebody who's willing to
we'll get some stark contrasts here.
Okay,
let's first take the question of the Jews. They came first, and I'm a Jewish. There are only 15 million Jews in the world, which is much less than the population of one Islamic city, Cairo. There are only 5 million Jews in Israel, which is a quarter of the population of Cairo. Judaism is a very, I hate to say this about my own people, but Judaism is a very parochial religion. All it really wants is a piece of land that's roughly the size of the Los Angeles metropolitan area, that is LA plus all of its suburbs. That is not a very big piece of land. There are three religions on the face of the planet which, instead of wanting a postage stamp of land, want the whole planet. One of them has been Christianity.
Right.
Christianity went through this phase primarily, that is a global phase, only in the 19th century, possibly the 19th and a little bit of the previous century. It was a relatively brief period of time between the rise of a global imperialism in Christianity and its defeat by anti-globalist movements. There was a period of 150 years, and some countries that were occupied, like Syria, were occupied for a total of 40 years, which is almost nothing
right on
the time scale of history. Buddhism has had a history of spreading itself peacefully. Not everything in Buddhism has been peaceful. There has been bloodshed and violence in Buddhism, but it's a very small slice of Buddhism's history. Islam is the most remarkable of all of these religions, because Islam has been waging a war that, as I said, has covered at least 13,500 miles worth of territory, at least the size of five Roman empires, for approximately 1,300 years, which outclasses Christianity, it outclasses Buddhism, it makes them all look shabby by comparison. Now, another question, let's go to the Crusades. The Crusades were over that same postage stamp of land, that same little bit of land. In fact, they were over a smaller slice of it than the metropolitan area of L.A.
Yeah, but in order to get to that postage stamp size of land, you had to go through Arizona and Colorado and Missouri.
No, you didn't. Because postage stamp size piece of land was on the coast, the Mediterranean coast, and Jerusalem, which is what they really wanted to take, was only about 20 to 30 miles inland.
Well, but I mean, I'm thinking about the damage that Crusaders did going across Western Europe.
But guess who they were damaging? You know what sort of babies they were roasting on fire? They were literally, I mean, these guys were barbarians, Crusaders. The Pope was put together the Crusade mostly to get rid of them, because they were savaging Europe. They were chopping up Europe like chopped sirloin. They were called the Fjord Normannorum. In other words, the Normannorum refers to the Normans. They were the Viking fury. These were the Vikings who had taken over in France. These were the Vikings who had taken over parts of England. And they were just running roughshod all over the place. The Pope basically said, hey, go fight someplace else. And he found them a tiny little playpen called the Holy Land. And that's where they stayed. And the Crusades lasted 217 years. Now, Ian, compare 217 years, which is a long time, to 1,300 years. 1,300 years is the length of Islam's planetary war, global war.
And so your feeling is that by comparison, I mean, and I'm obviously being hyperbolic here, but that what Islam has been doing for 1,300 years and the kind of militancy that is bubbling under the surface of modern Islam is makes the Crusades look like a beer run.
Absolutely.
Okay.
That's a very good way of putting it. And I think you put your finger on it when you said that there's basically a clash of civilizations within the Islamic community, because a tremendous part of the Islamic community in the West has adopted the values of Western culture. So the real clash of civilizations is going on within their communities, between themselves and their sons and their daughters. And I say daughters because we have had female suicide bombers in the West, especially in Russia. We've had, because this,
sure.
this jihad has been going on in Russia now since the late since about 1998. Apartment buildings have been blown up. 8-story apartment buildings have been totally leveled. Hundreds of people have been killed at a time. An entire theater audience has been taken captive by people shouting a slogan that we heard for the first time in the West when it was used in Moscow. We love death more than you love life. And we could go into the meaning of that and how it demonstrates a very radical difference in civilizations.
But again, it makes an interesting comparison, though, too. If people are looking for a historic precedent for that, we might say that to understand how Muslims can, as we saw in yesterday's bombing attacks in Iraq, put bombs outside of mosques in Baghdad in order to, you know, to kill the quote-unquote wrong Muslims or the soft Muslims or somehow the ones who have assimilated or the ones who have acquiesced to the jackboot of American imperialism.
Well, it isn't really so much that they've acquiesced to the jackboot of American imperialism. Sunni, the more militant of the Sunni Shiites have said that, of the Sunni Muslims, have said that the Shiites are unbelievers, apostates, and hypocrites.
Yeah.
Now, the sentence for an apostate or a hypocrite in the Quran is death, immediate death. So, yes, there have been wars within the Islamic community, and these wars have been fierce.
But to make that comparison, though, too, maybe we could go back to, say, historic precedent for that is to see how, again, in, say, Nazi Germany, you know, swept up in this new myth and the role that they played in shaping human history and the future, that they were willing, kids, Hitler youth were willing to turn in their own parents,
right?
Because they were wrong and they weren't, you know, they weren't pro Hitler enough.
Because the truth was more important than two human beings,
right?
Your father and your mother,
right?
And yes, the truth is more important, and paradise is forever. This earth is but for a short time, but paradise is forever.
Or in that case, the Reich was supposed to last forever, the thousand-year Reich.
But this is more like Christianity. Christianity in the Middle Ages, people were more concerned about their life after death than they were about their life on this planet.
Right.
And they were told to be more concerned about it because, after all, hell is forever. And you can see, for example, the church in Edinburgh, the old town church in Edinburgh that was built in the Middle Ages. It's one of the most horrific buildings you've ever seen in your life because it has these huge mass of sculptures on the front. And at the very top of the arch is Christ and God judging human beings on Judgment Day. Some of those human beings are spilling off in one side of the arch into hell, and the others are spilling off on the other side into heaven. The number spilling off into heaven is extremely small. The number spilling off into hell is extremely large, and the number of tortures that are portrayed on that building for the people who fall into hell is ingenious and horrific beyond belief. Well, that sort of Christianity has, for the most part, melted away since the Middle Ages. But that kind of belief in the afterlife is still very, very prevalent, especially among the militant Muslims.
All right. Well, let's take this moment here to take a breath before we come back to the question of the nuclear danger of it all. And I think it really hinges on this. With every bomb that goes off, I think that we all are somehow, maybe perhaps we don't vocalize, but in our subconsciouses, we are grateful that it wasn't a nuclear bomb. That was, you know, it was some 10-pound, you know, device made of C4, but that it was just conventional weaponry. And somehow we just keep waiting for that nuclear shoe to drop. And we'll come back to this with Howard Bloom. When does he expect this to happen? What does he see developing? And what is he advising his clients about in the world of militant Islamic terrorism next on Coast to Coast AM? My name's Ian Punnett. Howard Bloom was saying earlier how he believed Osama bin Laden was definitely behind the London bombings, and we talked a little bit about the history of this longest-running world war, and we talked about militant Muslims that are out to hurt Westerners whom they have minimalized, whom they have categorized and dismissed in their zeal to convert the world, to save the world from itself, that, you know, some eggs have to be broken to make an omelet. And in that militant terroristic mentality, which is growing more than perhaps those of us in the West really have thought about, Howard Bloom has been giving us some pretty strong warnings about how we need to rethink the way we look at these Muslims, this new group within a group, which is actually very ancient and much bigger than perhaps mainstream Islam would have us believe. So what is the nuclear danger from this militant Islam? And Howard, how do you see these bombs when they go off? Are you surprised that there hasn't been a nuke exploded yet?
I'm astonished that there hasn't been a nuke exploded yet. First, let me go back on the Osama thing. I don't think that Osama directly ordered the bombings in London and the bombings in Spain. He didn't have to. Osama has established himself as a myth. Osama has established himself as a role model and a legend. And in the same way that John Brown's body may be moldering in the grave, but as truth goes marching on, you know that old bit from the Battle Hymn of the Republic?
Right.
Well, in the same way, it doesn't matter whether Osama is dead or alive. By now, he has left his imprint, and it will last for a long time to come. The question is, will the human race last long enough to keep his imprint alive because of nuclear weapons? And back in 1988, when I finished the first draft of the Lucifer Principle, and Lucifer Principle, in essence, Amazon.com readers say that this is the book that predicted 9/11 and all of the events that have followed. And my publisher from Paris called last week, and he said, you called it again. How did you manage to predict in the Lucifer Principle what was going to happen in London? And how did you predict what's going to come in the next 10 to 15 years? So the book has a lot of predictive power, apparently. But when I first finished that manuscript, and even when it came out in 1995, I was told that I was a maniac. Why? Because I was saying, any minute now, Islam is going to have its hands on the perfect weapons for all of its rhetorical purposes, nuclear weapons. Why the perfect weapon for all of its rhetorical purposes? Because there are so many images of fire tormenting the unbeliever, that's you and me, in the Quran, that it defies the imagination. One, for example, is here's what's supposed to happen to you and me in hell. We'll be roasted on a spit and turned over and over again so that we scream as we feel each cell of our skin being scorched. But when our skin is finally crisped and blackened and falls off, we will be provided with an entirely new skin so that we can feel the screaming agony of that pain all over again. And it will continue in that way with new skins for us for infinity. With that kind of imagery, what kind of weapon would you choose? Now, here's a quote from Al-Qaeda's online magazine, Al-Ansar. The first part is something you'll find in many, 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 many different authors' words, Islamic authors' words. The elements of the collapse of Western civilization are proliferating. You'll find that all over the place. What you won't find is a little bit of the rest of this. Allah told us of the certainty of the annihilation of the infidels by means of the Muslim group, which would, in accordance with the Islamic commandment, torture them. The question now on the agenda is, how is the torture Allah wants done at our hands to be carried out? Well, we could go into the whole history of the Islamic nuclear weapon. It's ridiculous. The people were saying in 1995, Islam will never have a bomb, because in 1976, that's a long time ago, Pakistan's Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, I can't even pronounce his name, but its dictator announced that he was planning to build an Islamic bomb. And he said, in quotes, it would be a bomb for the defense of all Islamic countries. Now, the weird thing is the way that Islam tends to define defense. Anybody who threatens, quote, the purity of Islam is someone against whom one must mount a defense. In the words of the Ayatollah Khomeini, we have annihilated many a tribe because of its threat to corrupt Islam. Now, when CNN goes online in Arabic countries or in Malaysia or in Indonesia, a purist, a jihadist, how would he interpret that?
It's yeah, but
the corruption of Islam.
But wasn't Bhutto? I mean, I'm not an expert on this by any means. But if I remember correctly, wasn't he ultimately rejected by the Pakistani people for being too militant or too fundamentalist in his approach, and that they actually they sort of tested the boundaries of the Muslim nature of the country, in that they wanted to preserve some democracy and some pluralism.
First of all, you're brilliant. I mean, most people do not know this history at all. Secondly, they did get rid of Bhutto. But the fact is that by 1983, this is 7 years after this statement by Bhutto saying that he wanted to build the Islamic bomb, Abdul Qadir Khan, the father of the Islamic bomb, had snagged the complete design for a Chinese nuclear device that's only 34 inches in diameter. And guess what you can do with a nuclear device that's 34 inches in diameter? You can put it on a missile. That's 1983. So no matter what changes were going on in the government of Pakistan, Pakistan continued to work diligently to make nuclear devices. And by 1998, you know what happened. They had tested their first nuclear device. And guess what? It was a nuclear warhead. It was a 34-inch in diameter nuclear warhead designed to go on a missile.
So we have a minute. Give me in 60 seconds then your prediction on the use of a nuclear weapon by a Muslim extremist somewhere in the world.
There are two nuclear submarines in the water right now with a range of 11,000 miles. Each one carries 16 cruise missiles, and each of those cruise missiles is equipped with an atomic warhead. Those two super stealth submarines are both in the hands of the Islamic world, and they're both within easy grasp of Osama bin Laden. Now, figure that one out.
Well,
think what the consequences of that might be.
Well, and that wouldn't be just then you think perhaps somebody doing something in honor of Osama bin Laden, but rather that Osama bin Laden may be directing that one?
He may be directing that one, and even if he's dead, there are a lot of smart people that he has been educating for a very long time, and they can handle this.
Well, on that, we will come back and give you the numbers if you need them. If I were you, I'd start calling now and try to get through for Howard Bloom. We'll talk a little bit more about his book coming up, but we'll stay right here as Howard is schooling us on how we need to start rethinking Islamic terrorism. And what we need to think if we're able to ever do anything about it. Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM, my name's Ian Punnett. We are somewhere on the midway between Minneapolis and St. Paul. And we are midway between dusk and dawn with Howard Bloom. We're talking about the future and how we need to start thinking about Islamic terrorism if we're going to be serious about trying to do something about it, which begs the question, Howard, is what can we do to stop these bombings?
Well, I know what I personally tried to do, but it's not enough to stop the bombings. I personally tried to make as many friends in the Islamic community as I possibly can. I try to support those who are in favor of pluralism, freedom of speech, and the things that you and I believe in other words, Western culture, and support them in their right to believe in Islam. That is, their right to have the Quran as their holy book, Muhammad as their prophet, and to celebrate holidays like Ramadan, but also their right to open their mouths. Now, that's not enough to stop the bombing. And what astonishes me is I've been very, very anti-George Bush ever since I first heard of the man. And yet somebody's doing something right, or we would certainly have had bombings in the last, since 9/11.
So what do you think he's doing right?
That's a good question. I'll tell you one thing that I do know he's doing. And look, my friends are going to pelt me with rocks and stone me to death for ever saying anything nice about George Bush. I think his domestic policies are absolutely horrible. But when it comes to his policy toward Islam, he has a certain wisdom, I think, that goes beyond the intellect of all of my very intellectual friends. And one of the things that he's doing right is recognizing the degree of the danger. Something that my intellectual friends do not want to do. He is probably doing all kinds of things to thwart Islamic activism, things that we're not aware of because they're probably kept very secret. We know he's failing on a lot of things. We don't have the kind of monitoring of containers. We've got millions of containers coming into this country every year on container ships, and there's inadequate monitoring on them, or so we are told. But another thing that George Bush is doing right is this. Over the last 3 months, there's been a kind of a velvet revolution taking place in the Arab world. George Bush went on television back in February, and he said, look, this war is not really about weapons of mass destruction and never was. This war is about the fact that the Arab world has lived under tyrannies. An Arab world of 300 million people has lived under tyrannies for Lord knows how long. And it's time to get rid of that because there's a deep longing in the Arab people for democracy. And if we simply set an example in Iraq of a functioning democracy, the rest of the Arab countries will fall like dominoes to democracy. Now, I, being an expert in Middle Eastern affairs, among one of the many hats that I wear, and having spent time in the Middle East, thought that the man was crazy. I thought it was wonderful, idealistic, a wonderful idea, but so naive it was ridiculous. And then Rafiq Hariri, the former prime minister of Lebanon, was assassinated a few months ago. When Rafiq Hariri was assassinated, first in January, we had the elections in Iraq. The people in Iraq were told, you go to a voting booth and you are dead. Now, threats of this sort may sound idle to us when we live in a relatively safe country, but when entire villages in countries like Algeria have woken up the next morning to find their throats slit, in other words, they haven't woken up at all, their throats have been slit in the middle of the night, entire villages, and this is in our time, this is this year, last year, and the year before, then threats like this have to be taken very seriously. And yet the number of people who showed up for the Iraqi elections not only startled us, it gave a symbol of hope to an Islamic community that I wouldn't have believed existed, but that George Bush had accurately predicted did exist. So when Rafiq Hariri was killed, literally 800,000 people took to the streets of Lebanon, and through the kind of protests, in fact, they were deliberately imitating the protests of the 1960s, the civil rights protests in the United States, and they were deliberately responding to George Bush's statements about democracy, to his speech about democracy. Not only did people take to the streets and help throw the Syrians out of Lebanon, but people took to the streets in Damascus, Syria itself, women who wanted to know where their husbands, where their sons, and where their brothers had disappeared to 20 years ago, because this is a state of torture and killing. Now, taking to the streets in Damascus in a street demonstration is committing a death sentence on yourself. It's suicide, and yet women did it. There were similar demonstrations in Egypt. In fact, the Muslim Brotherhood, which is an extremist group that has been outlawed since 1951 in Egypt changed its tactics from tactics of killing everybody in sight to a tactic of going out on the street with placards and presenting its points of view in public. In Palestine, one of the Palestinian groups, there was a Palestinian demonstration in which instead of screaming, kill the Jews and carrying Kalashnikovs, the kids carried placards. And again, they imitated the civil rights protests of the 1960s in the United States. Why? Because they said, we've realized that our weapon is satellite TV, which of course is a gift of the West. The same kind of thing was happening in Bahrain, in Kuwait, and in Yemen. It was astonishing. And the only place I was able to find out about it, every night I watched for a half an hour the Arab news. That is, news from the various Arab stations in the Middle East.
Sure.
And American press was not covering this. Reuters was not covering this. Agence France-Presse, the French version of AP, was not covering this. The only people who were covering it was the Islamic television stations. And the reason the and this is doubly important. First of all, there was the importance of the demonstrations occurring, and secondly, there was the importance of the editorial decision on the part of the producers of the Islamic TV shows to go out on a limb and defy their own governments and carry the stories of these street protests night after night after night. Now, this all happened in approximately 1 to 2 weeks. I wrote a piece on it. I put together an instant group online that included a friend of mine in the State Department, a friend of mine in the intelligence community, a friend of mine who is the he's the managing editor of a huge publishing group in Dubai, and a friend who is a member of the Islamic community. He's the Nobel Peace Prize nominee, former Minister of Education of Malaysia, and the founder of the two leading Islamic journals in the Islamic world, plus a friend named Don Beck, who has who is able to get to people like Tony Blair and George Bush and Bill Clinton, and has spent a fair amount of time with these people. And I said, am I hallucinating? Is this really happening? Or is this just my wishful thinking? And laid out what I'd seen in terms of these Islamic street protests suddenly taking on a democratic, pro-democratic character. And my friend in the Islamic community, after we'd had this discussion for a couple of weeks, got back to me a few weeks later when I was losing faith, when I was thinking that it had been an hallucination, even though all of the friends that I wrote to said, you're not hallucinating. He got back to me once again, uncertainty set in, and he said, Howard, do not give up on us. Please do not give up on us. You're the only voice speaking in our words for us. I wish I could get your words to the Islamic community, but this is what we want. This is what we have been striving for. Please continue to be our voice. Please do not give up on us. This is the man who has founded the two leading journals on Islamic studies in the Islamic world.
Well, that's not just flattering. I think it's very helpful, too. And can I say, and I don't know, I don't often digress into politics here for a second, but I don't know. I've always felt like, you know, getting Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait was a lot of effort for what I think of, and I know this is terrible, but kind of a miserable little country. I've never thought much about Kuwait.
Right.
But, you know, so in a way, I thought we kind of did the wrong thing, though, for the right reason. I mean, Saddam invaded, but we didn't. We stopped too early. We really didn't do anything. We seemed to embolden Saddam Hussein, everybody thinking that he had actually, you know, triumphed over the U.S. in the fact that he was able to get the U.S. to stop at his borders, basically, and that that was that. But I think, oddly enough, in the second visit to the Persian Gulf, in the Persian Gulf War II, I think we have done the right thing for the wrong reason. We said we were going in for something else, but I've always believed that we may have done the right thing out of it, and that somewhere in the middle of that, for me, Howard, and as a person of faith, I always say somewhere in the middle of that to me is God. No matter what we do, somehow we can move forward, and we can make it better. And I'd like to think of the optimism in what you say there, that regardless of how we justified it, the fact is something right may be happening here that could end up saving a lot more lives than we realize now, if we're just to judge it only on the headlines from today.
Well, I think that in many ways you're right. When my friends my friends are all on the left, and when my friends sent me an article about George Bush and his religious beliefs, They thought it would turn me off because I spent the 1980s fighting the religious right in the United States of America, who were trying to censor rock and roll, for example. So I ran a group called Music in Action, in which I went toe-to-toe with Tipper Gore, who was being used as a pawn by the radical religious right. But when I read this particular article and it gave me a sense of George Bush's faith, I all of a sudden had a faith in George Bush, because I felt that this was a man who might be working from the heart, who might be working from the gut. And that's what his belief in God had led him to, working from the heart and gut. Now, when I set up that little ad hoc internet group that I told you about, that I put together to check me on my accuracy about a Velvet Revolution in the Middle East, the person who came back to me with the most compelling bit of information was my friend Don Beck, who's the founder of the Spiral Dynamics Movement and the Human Emergence Movement. And Don said, look, when I went over to the ranch in Texas to spend the afternoon with George Bush, the first thing he asked me was, Don, 20 to 40 years from now, when our grandchildren look back at this meeting we're having today in our office, what's the most obvious mistake that they feel we will have made? What's the most obvious thing that we should have done? They will know it, but we don't. Because let's take care of it now, before they have to second-guess us with the hindsight of history. Well, to me, that is the question of a very wise man. I don't get the impression that George Bush is very wise. I don't get the impression that he's very intellectual. Don tells me Don tells me he's very bright, and Don tells me he's very poorly informed.
Well,
he hasn't had a great education, despite going to Yale, but that he is a bright man. Now, another friend called me just a few days after Don had given me this story and said, do you know how intellectuals present themselves in the South? And I didn't. I have no idea. It's a different language. I hadn't realized that there's a different way of projecting yourself as an intelligent man below the Mason-Dixon line. He said, like George Bush.
Yep.
So, though I am very against Bush's domestic policies, I think that George Bush's faith may sometimes be leading him very much in the right direction.
Well, let's stop there, and I promise everybody who's been waiting on hold to talk to Howard Bloom that I will limit the rest of my questions to things like, what are you wearing, and what time is it, and stuff, so that I don't get Howard away from you, who have been waiting patiently to talk to him, coming up next. When it comes to Tipper Gore and the religious right, Howard, I'm not sure who is using whom, though, there, and we'll come back to this with you next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. Howard Bloom, you can link up to him at howardbloom.net through the Coast to Coast website. And you can also purchase either of his books in the past, or just to give you an idea of how smart Howard is, you can buy a book he hasn't actually written yet, and you can buy it right now. It hasn't even been written yet. You can buy it. Let's go to the wild card line, where Daryl has been hanging on patiently for Howard Bloom on Coast to Coast AM. Go ahead, Daryl.
Hey, how y'all doing?
It's a pleasure.
You know, Howard has really positioned himself completely back the administration's support of what they're doing. Bin Laden is Hitler. Islam is too big for us to fight. And then the thing they're pushing now, 24 nukes, but he included two subs that are full of nukes. So I think that goes right along with the picture that the Republican Party is trying to push right now. But the point I wanted to ask about was during the election, when Bush's numbers plummeted, they went and circled the building in New York and said it was a terrorist threat. And, of course, they pulled Osama bin Laden out just in the nick of time to win the election. And the day before the bombing, of course, everybody knows Karl Rove's politically in trouble because he leaked CIA information. You know, he's controlling world events by leaking stuff at the right time, which, you know, we all know, I feel like he's been behind it the whole time. And
But we got to get to a question right away, Daryl, if we're going to have a chance for an answer.
Okay. Is there any connection between this administration's in trouble political problems and the terrorist activity? Because we haven't seen nothing in 3 months, and now Rove is in trouble, and now we've got 24 nukes and a bombing in London.
Well, the 24 nukes is something that I've been talking about for the last year and a half to 2 years. So it has nothing to do with Karl Rove whatsoever. The London bombings, I think it would be a bit strange to think that the London bombings took place because Karl Rove was in trouble. The Spanish train bombings, 13 bombs planted and 10 bombs going off almost simultaneously, I don't think that would be likely something that Karl Rove could have set up. I know that the belief is widespread, and you may hold it, that in fact 9/11 and the bombing of the World Trade Center was not caused by Islamic militants at all, that it was done by our local boys. It was done by the CIA, it was done by the FBI, and it was done by the Mossad, and it was done by the CIA, the FBI, and the Mossad in order to put George Bush in a position to declare martial law, to inflict, to destroy our civil rights with the Patriot Act, and you can find sites on the web that are 178 pages long and have such detailed footnotes on exactly why two planes could not possibly have toppled the buildings at the World Trade Center, that they make a very, very persuasive case. But the fact is that 1,300 years or 1,400 years of Islamic history does not lie.
And let's go to Ted, wild card as well, for Howard Bloom on Coast to Coast AM. Ted?
Good morning, Ian.
Hi,
morning.
Ted.
Good morning, Howard. Excellent show. I had a question and a comment. So many things have been covered in your topic this evening while I was on hold. So I had to revise my question. I wanted to know about the way women are treated in Islam, and also about Arafat's uncle, the Grand Mufti, if he was involved in the Final Solution against the Jews.
Well, you know that the Grand Mufti, his uncle, went off to make a trip to Germany, that most of the Arab world signed on with the Nazis as a, can't call them an accomplice, as an ally in World War II. The
right.
Grand Mufti, who was Yasser Arafat's uncle, went off to Germany, and he was taken to see a concentration camp, or so it is said. He was taken to see a concentration camp filled with nothing but Jewish children, just Jewish children. And he basically said, why are you keeping these scum alive? You know that these are insects polluting the earth. And to show him a gesture of hospitality, it is said that Hitler had that entire concentration camp filled with children killed. He killed them to satisfy the Grand Mufti. And that's pretty much how the Grand Mufti felt the Jews should be killed, should be treated. So that, again, that's not a story I've ever gone back to the sources on to check up on, but that is one of the stories about the Grand Mufti. Now, what was the other question again?
The other question was just about, I don't remember what the rest of the question was, actually. I'm sorry. I was so interested in your answer that I lost track of it. Well, let's try for Charlie here, and we'll keep his question short, and then Howard can keep his answer short, and we'll probably have time to get them both in. Charlie?
I kind of doubted you stole my thunder. Thanks for being there tonight. You didn't restrict yourself soon enough, so I'm going to have to revise it. Howard, thank you for being on tonight.
Hi, Charlie.
Short question. Thanks a lot. Right before the break.
Well, I'll tell you what. You get the question here, and we'll save Howard's answer, okay?
Yeah, or keep me on after the deal because I want to hear it. My concern is how we combat the jihad. And I have absolutely no faith in any governments around the world to do that because they're on an agenda that's prescribed. And I'm really shocked, Howard, to hear you attribute anything positive to Mr. Bush except for reading the scripts that are handed to him.
Well, you know what? I tell you what, I want you to hang on to that thought, Charlie, because I would offer, and I'll throw in this along with Howard's answer coming up, that I think part of your question may actually prevent you or prevent us from getting a solution. And we'll just hold on to that and we'll come back to it because I'd love to hear more from everybody. We've got all the lines lit up. There's room for you coming up next. Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett.